Have you ever noticed that politicians struggle to enact the things they run on? And that regardless of who wins elections, lawmakers cannot pass just whatever legislation they like. They are bound by the Overton window. This concept, coined by the Mackinac Center's Joe Overton, describes the range of ideas that are politically acceptable at any time. Politicians typically only act within a narrow window of policy ideas. And on the Overton Window podcast, we talk to people who work to shift the Overton window and change what is politically possible. I'm Mike Van Beek, Director of Research at the Mackinac Center, and joining me today is Chris Supernot, who is a professor of ethics, strategy, and public policy at the University of New Orleans, and director of the Urban Entrepreneurship and Policy Institute at the university. Chris has a doctorate in philosophy from Boston University, and he also serves on the Mackinac Center's Board of Scholars. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
Well, let me start by asking what might be a bit of a personal question. I don't know of anyone who has similar interests as you do in the policy realm. You've studied philosophy, and then you got interested in criminal justice reform and then urban entrepreneurship, and now you're working on improving and expanding financial education in high school. Can you explain a little bit the evolution of your interest there and how some of those things are tied together?
Yeah, of course. Look, so I'm not going to, I mean, I'm plugging the Mackinac Center here, right? I get my brochure in the mail with everything you guys are doing, and it's called Impact, right?
Yeah.
And that's what's driven my career decisions and sort of the things I've pursued. I was at Tulane University for a while, and I was doing a regular philosophy stuff. I was teaching logic, course in the history of philosophy, and I had this offer to leave Tulane University and go over to the University of New Orleans. For people who don't know, the University of New Orleans is a public university that aims to serve the city of New Orleans, mostly serving lower middle class people in New Orleans, a lot of first generation college students, people who see the University of New Orleans as the place that is going to allow them to make their lives better and their kids' lives better. That's why they're there. Most of them are paying their own way. Students work really hard there. And so one of the things that I realized when I was making that move to the University of New Orleans is that my salary is now being paid by students who are interested in real world things. It's being paid to a certain extent by the state. I felt like I needed to justify what I was researching and what I was teaching to people on the street. Why do I get tax dollars? What justifies that? And quite honestly, no one cares about the moral and political philosophy of Immanuel Kant. I mean, some people do, right? Enough people do. I got a PhD, right? Enough people do. But when it comes to the vast majority of people, minute problems or things in the history of philosophy or ethical questions that, you know, normal people don't even bother to think about, it doesn't really move the needle. And so a lot of the work I'd been doing was in political philosophy. And I was thinking, what are the problems that are facing the city of New Orleans? How can I use my voice? And I'm from New Orleans, the connections I have in New Orleans to help move the needle on some of these issues. And the real issue that we had at that time, and to still have to a certain extent, was criminal justice issues, criminal justice reform, how the laws are often applied unequally across the city to people, depending on where they're arrested. And I didn't mean where, like where in the city, who they are. Issues related to, say, bail. You look at who's in the jail and how many people who are poor and Black who are sitting in our jail because they can't come up with $200 to get bailed out of something ridiculous. And so that's what started a lot of it, was work in criminal justice reform that came out of our work in political philosophy. And then, you know, it sort of kind of developed from there that we started working with people who convinced me that the solution to a lot of the criminal justice problems were connected to economic opportunity in some of these communities. And so that got us to some community development issues, some entrepreneurship issues. And then that research turned into some of the most recent stuff, which is on financial education, financial literacy for high school students.
Yeah. And so what, thinking about financial literacy and education, so why is that more important maybe than what most people think? Because it's not a topic that is heavily pushed in schools. Well, you know, why isn't it more commonly taught in high schools and universities?
Okay, so separate out those two questions.
Yeah.
The question of, like, why is it not more commonly taught? And the second one is why is it but needs to be, you know, you think of it in terms of its importance. The teaching bit, I think, is actually over the last 5 years, there's been a substantial change that the vast majority of states now are requiring some type of financial literacy education. It varies by state, but we're almost to the point where over half the states of the country are requiring some sort of course in the high school to have the students graduate. So we're moving in that direction. So that's something that's at, you know, over the next couple of years, I think everyone coming out of a high school is going to have some sort of course or some sort of education in financial literacy, broadly understood. Whether or not it's any good is part of the problem right now. And this is what we got into, because the reality is that the vast majority of people are very bad at managing their own finances. They're very bad at making financial decisions. They're very bad at understanding the long-term consequences of the decisions they make. You know, I'm a university professor. I was at a private university for a long period of time that had one of the highest tuition costs in the country. We had a number of students who would come in, take out, you know, literally $100,000-$200,000 in loans to come out with a degree. And again, I don't like thinking about loans in terms of degrees and whatnot, but coming out with a job prospect situation where they were not ever going to pay that money back in any reasonable way. So from a financial standpoint, it was not the best financial decision. But those people are coming from, in many cases, reasonably well-off families. The people we're working with are not. And the decisions they're making are being pushed to make by people or institutions or whomever that are, quite honestly, quite predatory, that are taking advantage of them not knowing, basic things about finances, about how interest rates work. That's why we got involved. And so I've had the good fortune to work with a number of professional athletes, close working with Marcus Colston, who was on the Saints for a while. And he thinks this is probably one of the most important issues facing the Black community right now in the United States is, can we understand personal finances, how to manage it, and especially looking at kids in college athletes getting all this money through NIL deals and whatever else, that a lot of these people, they're not going to be able to go pro, but they're getting money right now that should be enough to help them make significant progress in their lives. How can we help them manage it? How can we help high school students make better financial decisions? How can we put people who, you know, really were dealt bad hands and are worse off due to no fault of their own? How can we help them help themselves to not make bad decisions when it comes to personal finance? So that's what's motivated a lot of this. And what's fortunately, we've had the good fortune of getting some grants from organizations that are interested in supporting this mission. So we had some success, remove the needle. It's just, it's tough. It's tough. Yeah.
It seems like it seems odd that, you know, until recently, financial education was not as heavily prioritized, because obviously it can make a big difference in a person's life outcomes. You know, if they've managed their money well and been responsible and sort of fiscally conservative and responsible in what they do, it can have a huge impact on their life. But it's not maybe it's my ignorance, but I don't remember it being part of any kind of government welfare programs or these sorts of things to help people in this way. A lot of those seem to be about just providing support monetarily or through, you know, food or supplies or those kinds of things, but not teaching people how to manage the resources they have. Can you comment a little bit on that or where that is?
Well, the Small Business Association, which is funded by the federal government, has been running clinics, money management clinics, for quite a while. I mean, they've been targeted at adults, younger adults. You've got organizations like Junior Achievement and other groups like that are federally funded and state funded that are providing some financial literacy programs and through entrepreneurship. But look, the reality is that the vast majority of people who are coming from families who are minimally financially responsible are getting a lot of that education at home. And so when you look at it and you look at the people who are making a lot of the policy decisions, they didn't get their financial education from school. They got it from their parents. And one of the groups that we're trying to work with and we're trying to provide assistance to are the folks who can't get that at home because their parents, that the parents will tell you that they're bad at managing the money. This isn't like Chris coming in as the white guy from New Orleans saying, you're terrible at managing your money. They're the parents and the teachers too in the schools, often the teachers who are slated to teach these classes, tell us, we're not good at managing our money. I want to take this class along with the kids, or I want to take this class along with the students, because this is something they recognize that they need to get better at, and the resources weren't there to help them improve those things. So I think it's more of an issue of it's not super sexy. And quite honestly, there are a lot of people who have been taking advantage of these folks. It's to the interest of a lot of people to keep people financially ignorant. Now, whether it's the government's job to get involved in that, I'm not sure, because in many cases, the government's part of the problem here on some of these issues.
Yeah.
But it's a serious problem. And look, I mean, I'm critical of politicians at all levels. I applaud the politicians at these state levels, recognizing there's a problem, as best as I can tell. Right. Normally, we think when politicians pass laws, it's because they're being incentivized to do so by someone who's profiting off of it. We haven't found anyone who's pushing for any of these financial education laws or financial education programs because they're going to profit off it. So I think people recognize there's a problem. When you look at debt in this country, when you look at how people are spending their money, when you look at how people are making decisions, the question is, well, how do we help people make better decisions? And that's why we got involved, why I got involved. But it's been a frustrating 3 years looking into this issue compared to criminal justice reform. We were able to move the needle pretty quickly on some of the criminal justice reform issues. This is much harder because I think it's not so much about changing laws. It's not so much about saying, hey, maybe we don't put the people with the marijuana violations in the jail. This is a much deeper issue. We have a lot of people who, you know, they're going through the schools and they're not learning a lot. And so to pile on financial education there and to hope that folks come out of it, understanding that when right now many aren't coming out understanding basic math or reading or writing or history, that's going to be a heavy lift.
Yeah, that makes sense. You mentioned earlier about the quality of the financial education that's provided. So it's one thing to pass a law to require all students to take this class before they graduate. But what are some of the elements of a really good financial education course that will be beneficial to students?
So, you know, one of the things we found is that it's not so much the course, but the teacher. And this is the real problem. So we went in and we had a 3-year project. And one of the things we wanted to do was look at the curriculum and the curricula being taught in the various courses across different states and how to what extent curricula mattered or a curriculum, like a standardized curriculum. So we were able to come in, look to see what the teachers were doing. We worked with the teachers. We then standardized the curriculum with their input. They taught the standardized curriculum. And what was interesting is that standardizing the curriculum and having some curriculum that, you know, the teachers had input into and us, you know, fancy professors, like we thought we knew, like the results really weren't that good. What mattered was teachers who had some background in financial education. They cared about personal finances. They had some interest in entrepreneurship. They incorporated entrepreneurship in some way in their classroom to get the kids like actually working with money and making real decisions instead of doing like simulations in the class. And you had teachers who cared. So it was a teacher who cared, was knowledgeable, and then incorporated some sort of real world activities that had the kids managing real money. Those are the things that seem to have the most impact. Because otherwise, I mean, you could run a financial education class 100 different ways. I mean, you have a semester, you have 100 different topics, you got to pick what you're going to do, you're going to leave stuff out. But what we found was that it was the teachers that mattered. And so then the question becomes like, how do you get better teachers?
Right.
And that's the challenge. I mean, the good news, I mean, so right now you've got a lot of teachers who don't have the backgrounds in many of these states teaching the classes. What we found, though, is that as the laws have been in place, for, you know, 5-10 years, right, where some of the states where they've been in place a little bit longer, like, say, Tennessee, you've got schools and school districts that are hiring specifically for financial literacy classes because all the kids have to take it. And instead of like piecing together who's teaching it, you'll have like two financial literacy instructors. that seems to have worked out better. So you have people who are actually hired to do it. That's not the case everywhere. You would think, well, aren't they hiring financial literacy teachers? No, because, you know, even if you have to cover a class and even if everyone has to take the class, it's kind of like health in some cases, right? You just, who needs the section at third period?
Right.
Right. Well, it just so happens that the assistant track coach needs a class to fill his schedule. So why don't we give the assistant track coach the financial literacy class? And so we're seeing that in some cases, and it's rough. And the teachers will admit to you, like, so we'll survey the teachers, and they're quite honest. They say, look, I don't have the background of teaching this class. I was told to teach the class. I was assigned the class. So I teach the class. And I'm trying my best, but I'm not very good. And you feel for those teachers.
Yeah.
You really do. And they recognize they're in a tough spot. They're trying to do the best they can. And the outcomes aren't great in many cases.
Yeah. I studied education policy for several years, and what you're describing here is not new to me at all, because this is the same kind of challenge that schools have teaching anything. You know, the research clearly shows that teacher quality matters more than anything else that happens inside of the school when it comes to improving the instruction and improving the achievement of the students. I wonder if it just got me thinking about, you know, schools starting to hire financial literacy teachers directly. It seems like it could be a good second career maybe for some people who went into, I don't know, you know, some of these finance nerds who went into accounting or, you know, some other sort of field like that and then want to do something different, maybe mid-career. Have you had any experience with that? People changing careers and becoming teachers and drawn to that financial literacy in particular?
It's tough. It's tough because the schedule is so demanding. The pay is terrible. Mm. You know, even if someone wanted to come in to teach one or two classes, a lot of the schedules for these high schools, they're rotating blocks. And so it's not consistent for someone who wants to work some other job. Or like, you can't expect someone to come in at 10 a.m. on a Monday and 2 p.m. on a Tuesday and, you know, 11 a.m. on a Wednesday. Haven't seen a lot of that. I mean, I think you've got a lot of people who are interested in, at least in the schools we've worked with, from the local community coming in and giving guest lectures and things like that.
Oh, okay.
But it's much tougher to find the teachers. But look, so I know you're interviewing me, but I got a question on what you just said.
Yeah.
So you've looked at education. This is right. Flipping it a little bit here. What did you find that got better teachers into the classroom? I mean, you've done work on this. Like, how do you get those better? Because everyone just says, well, increase their pay, right? Pay them more and the better teachers will come. And to some extent that might be true, but what did you find?
Well, it's a challenge. I don't think anyone has the answer to it. And that's why it's been a perennial problem for schools. Is it's not just one thing that will attract those teachers. It's often the case as well that the very high performing teachers, like teachers who come in right out of the gate and start doing well in the first few years, are also teachers who are the most likely to leave, because they're just high performing people in general. And so they're going to be lured away, more likely be lured away for a higher paying job or some other kind of opportunity. Most of it is actually just the opportunity to go into an institution where they can grow and get promoted and that kind of thing. When you're in a school system, you know, and you're a teacher, your chances for promotion and growth in your career are very limited, right? Like, you can become the head teacher, the lead teacher, or you can become the principal or the superintendent, and that's pretty much it, right? So, you know, there's not a lot of opportunities there. So I think it's a mixture of trying to create incentives for high-performing teachers to stay. I actually know of a program here in Michigan that is connected to Teach for America, if you're familiar with that program. So they've got a lot of teachers who are non-traditionally educated in teaching schools, but who come into Detroit Public Schools and teach for a few years. And this program is finding the teachers who are having the greatest impact, and they're just paying them bonuses to try to get them to stay in the classroom and continue to teach. And they're doing it outside of the typical pay structure that teachers have, which is through a union contract and negotiated with the district. This is like an added on bonus for them. So it seems to be working a little bit in that program, but it's just getting started, and they're going to, you know, see where they're at in 4 or 5 years and see if it makes a difference. But it's not a new issue. It's not an easy nut to crack.
Well, and that's what we ended up having to do too. We did the same thing as we paid pitchers on top of what they were receiving. I mean, you know, one of the crazy things though, you know, so we're primarily working in low income public schools where a lot of the students are going to be Pell eligible. The number of students who aren't attending classes. So you'll have 30 kids in the class and you'll have 12 kids, 14 kids show up on any given day to class. And it's a different 12 or 14.
Right.
That's the, I say, okay, 12 to 14 show up and people are like, well, it's the same 12. No, it's not the same 12 to 14. And so you can't do lesson plans. You can't do anything when, you know, half the kids aren't there in class and you never know which half it's going to be. It's incredibly, incredibly difficult for a lot of these teachers. They're put in just really, really tough spots. And that's something that, you know, I don't want anyone in this is whether this interview or any of the work we've done, we never want to come across as disparaging any of the teachers that we've worked with. I tell you this, like some of them are put in incredibly tough spots. We have yet to meet a teacher in some of these high schools that don't care. All of them care. They're trying to do the best that they can. And they are just put in like really, really, really tough spots. You know, it's like, and they all have different skills, right? It's like a quarterback who's put in there and has no offensive line and no running back. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, you can tell them to throw the ball up to a receiver, but unless you're like, I mean, Culpepper and Moss back when the Vikings were playing when I was little and all I did was just like heave the ball up, right? Unless you have something like that at a school, like it's an incredibly difficult situation.
Yeah.
Which is what has made this work so incredibly frustrating working with these high schools and the students. It's not because the high schools are frustrating. It's because, you know, at the end of the day, too, is that a lot of the administrators need to satisfy certain state requirements. And so you're sitting there and you got to satisfy the state requirements. You got to check off all the various boxes. And they know that the checking off the boxes is getting in the way of actually educating. But if you don't check off the boxes, you're going to run into more problems. Mm-hmm. So this is the one of the things I appreciate, you know, about what you guys are doing is that, you know, you look at how much red tape there is and you look at how much bureaucracy there is in education. And for people who can afford alternatives, it doesn't matter. You can get around that. Like my kids go to a private schools. And so if like we don't have that problem. But I couldn't imagine sending my kids to some of these schools, and it's not the kids' fault, and it's not the parents' fault that that's their only option. And so the more that we can do, and so, I mean, I know you guys in Mackinac have been working on this. New Orleans was a test case for a fully voucher program, right, with schools. The more that we can do to give educational opportunities and alternatives to people, and also to give insert some competition into the educational landscape to try to address these problems. It doesn't fix what we've got going on right now, but the hope is that something like that will make it better for the kids coming up. Because again, it's not their fault that they don't have alternatives. You know, that's not their fault. And it's just unlucky. And just because someone's been unlucky shouldn't mean that they're necessarily going to get these worse outcomes. So that's what motivated all of this. You know, I think I was raised that when you're in a spot where you've got things that have been given to you or you've been born with certain talents, you need to go and try to help people who are in worse shape. And what that means is also in terms of helping people, it doesn't mean you go in and say, well, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, right? Because that's a lot of times what you see with various types of interventions. You've got to listen to what the people in those situations want. What is it that they want? What are the problems that they recognize? How can they fix these problems themselves? You know, one of the things that I'm in the background to a lot of our work. You know, every once in a while, I'll go into the schools and I'm the only white guy in the school at that point. Right. And I'll go and meet with the teacher. I'll meet with the administrator and I get out of there. It's not that I don't want to be there, but it's I want them to make the decisions. I'm here to facilitate. I'm here to try to write checks in some cases, provide funds. But otherwise, they need to figure out, like, what is it that they need? Because they know their community. They know their school. Mm-hmm. They know their situation much better than I do. And what, you know, one school needs and the other school six blocks away need, they can be completely different things. And if you go into education or really anything with a one size fits all, this is how we're going to fix this problem, right? Which is a lot of the top down stuff. This is how we're going to fix it. It never works. It doesn't work.
Yeah. Is that part of what motivated the entrepreneurship focus that you've been on too? To me, it sounds like it's a similar kind of approach of helping people help themselves, getting, you know, sort of tapping into maybe their natural desire or creativity to build a business and do something on their own. Is that related to that?
Yeah, not just do something on their own, but do something that provides value to their community. Mm. I mean, we, you know, a lot of the entrepreneurship right now, you watch it on Shark Tank or whatever else, and it's like these sexy big companies like biotechs and whatever. We weren't doing any of that. We're not doing any of that. We're working with hairdressers. We're working with the guy who, my daughter was three, she called him Tire Wheels, right? The guy who's selling the tire shop. Right. He's got used tires and he's trying to put a mic on people's cars who don't have any tires. Like, we're working with people who are cooking food in their house and selling with people who are doing construction. I mean, a lot of this stuff is under the table too. But these are people who are trying to make their lives better because they found a need in the community that they're providing a solution to. To me, like that type of creation and that type of I see a problem. I'm going to address that problem. To me, that's what entrepreneurship is about. And it's how entrepreneurs make our community better. I don't have any problems with people who make millions of dollars. Not at all. But when you look at some of the communities we're working with, we're not working with multi-million dollar companies. We're working with someone who's bringing in $10,000, $20,000 so that they can pay for things they can pay medical bills for their kids. They can put food on the table. And how do they do that? They identified a problem in their community and they're trying to find a solution to it. And to me, that's what makes this country, that's what makes entrepreneurship great. And it's why it's so important to support these people.
Yeah. What kind of policy issues are tied up into that effort to promote entrepreneurship in urban areas? Like what are the obstacles to people pursuing their, you know, their goals for creating a business or earning their own money?
Well, with the group, a number of the people we're working with right now, it's ICE coming around in New Orleans and picking people up. So that's the first thing, which is outrageous. But that's a discussion for another day, probably. You know, the other thing, the more and less politically charged answer is that a lot of these people are having to operate under the table because they're receiving a significant amount of government benefits. And if they earn over a certain amount, they lose all of those benefits. And there's a huge cliff.
Yeah.
And this is a real thing. And these people, they're not stupid. They know exactly how much they need to earn legally to keep their benefits. And when you have someone, say, on Section 8 housing vouchers or where they're getting food, school lunches or other things for their kids, they tell you, I am not jeopardizing my kids' lunches. I'm not jeopardizing our apartment. I can't take that risk. Yes, it would be great if I tried to grow my business into something that made $100,000, $200,000 a year, but I can't take that risk that I can cover that difference, that cliff, when I lose my benefits before that business picks up. And so to me, if we're looking at, say, policy moves that could fix a lot of these problems with a lot of the people we're working with, I think it's great to encourage people to get off the benefits. They don't want to be on the benefits themselves in many cases, but a gradual reduction instead of, in some case, it's like you either hit the number or you don't. And that's a real problem. It's causing a lot of these people to not be able to grow their businesses or accumulate the wealth that we would like them to be able to accumulate.
Yeah, that makes some sense because it would allow them a little bit of a safety net for when they're trying to go out on their own, taking that risk of starting their own business out on their own, and then they still have a little bit of that welfare safety net behind them. It seems like that would make sense to encourage more people to try to become an entrepreneur.
Well, they're entrepreneurs now. It's just they're not declaring their income.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
they're entrepreneurs. They're making money, right? And this is what, you know, we got this grant a couple of years ago to try to understand how much of this type of activity is going on. There's a lot of it. It's just not being recorded. And one of the challenges is that we want to understand from the standpoint of the government, it's not just about paying taxes, but you want to know what's going on to provide people with services and to understand what type of activity is going on in the community. And when it's a lot of it's under the table, it's hard to do that. But it also means that they're limited in terms of how they can grow the business. It's very hard to employ people when you're operating under the table. It's very hard. You can't get licenses when you're operating under the table. You can't rent buildings when you're operating under the table. I mean, you can't, but it's tougher.
Yeah.
Right.
You're
taking a huge, like, to grow the businesses, you need to be able to do those things. And so the more people we can get to not operate under the table, but we also understand why are they operating under the table. And we've got to address those issues.
Yeah. Well, Chris, it flew by. That's all the time we have for this episode. Thanks very much for being our guest. And we hope that you listening in will tune into the next podcast of The Overton Window.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Overton Window, a podcast from the Mackinac Center. Please subscribe and rate. For more, check us out at www.mackinac.org. That's Mackinac with a C, like the island.